You're listening to ABC Radio National's MP3 and podcast of Late Night Live. Find out more, go to abc.net.au/rn.
G'day Gladys, welcome to LNL. In just a moment, Christian Kerr will take his crikey scalpel and slit open the soft underbelly of Canberra politics, releasing the aliens within. And then we're off to Wormwood Forest, because it seems a good time to revisit Chernobyl. At the moment, of course, there's a lot of pressure for us to get rid of our greenhouse gases by an increasing reliance on nuclear power, following the example of countries from Sweden to France. But clouding, indeed mushroom clouding the issue, are the odd problems like Three Mile Island, which I'm reliably informed went close to wiping out quite a bit of the United States, and of course Chernobyl, which is almost exactly 20 years ago. And memories come rushing back as I drove in to do the program. I suddenly recalled that I was flying over Chernobyl at the height of the crisis. I was quite astonished to be told that by the captain of the jumbo jet. We're on our way to the Cannes Film Festival, would you believe, and that was almost deserted because of the fear, the belief, in fact, that fallout was all over the south of France and had done awful things to the French vegetables. So we're going to go back to Chernobyl tonight, and you will be astonished at what's been going on, because, yes, there is any number of overgrown ghost towns and buried villages, but there's also an abundance of flora and fauna, some of which had been rare and verging on extinction in the region before the accident. Then we're going to open the archives, the secret files on the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Third Reich. Everyone knows the story about how the Witnesses were singled out by the Nazis and added to the death list for the camps, along with Jews and Gypsies. But there is another side to the story, which is just emerging. But first of all, to Christian Kerr with his scalpel, tell us, apply it if you would, apply that your tool to the IR issue, which you describe as the sleeper at the moment.
If you thought Telstra was bad, Philip, you ain't seen nothing yet. That well-known advisor to the Prime Minister, Bill Heffernan, got up in the Senate on the first day of this session, and I don't know why no one's actually made more of this. He pulled a point of order, and he said, "Mr. President, I think that Senator Brown is out of order because he's trying to turn the chamber into a place that competes with Desperate Housewives and gets the ratings up." Now, if we've had a bit of soap opera and a bit of drama over Telstra, I think IR is going to be bigger and bigger and bigger. We haven't actually seen the legislation. We don't quite know when we're going to see the legislation.
But surely it's being rapidly modified in the light of every protest that comes along.
Well, that's the actual thing. Just quite how much can you modify it? Because, I mean, the government last week was talking Question Time about the 4,000 awards that proliferate across the country. This is something that's going to have to cover the territory that those 4,000 awards covers, and then on top of covering that ground, it's going to have to cover absolutely every contingency. I mean, it looks like the government's attempting the impossible and rapidly discovering that's the case. You've got to wonder if they're going to actually shove the legislation and try and deal with the rest of the impossible later.
Well, apart from offering a lifeline to Kim Beazley, if he cares to take it, one would have to suspect that they've bitten off more than they can chew with this one.
Yes, and certainly the issue of who's actually going to swallow it, when you think of some of the states' rights people within the coalition, the different interests of different sized business groups. Not only have the government bitten off more than they chew, but there's quite a lot of lobby groups out there that should be on their side who just aren't prepared to swallow what the government is offering.
For instance, who are the surprising allies of the trade union movement?
Well, I'm not even going to mention a certain Queensland senator. You can guess who he is.
Oh, the one with the Dickensian name that we neither of us will say.
Yes. Mr. Drudge? No. The Western Australian Senator, Dave Johnson, has had some complaints about the legislation. You've had the oppositions in a number of these states. The Liberal oppositions actually raised queries about it. Then there's that famous 100 employees mark when the legislation kicks in. Does it apply? Does it not? This is really a fantastic government, one-size-fits-all and doesn't please anybody solution.
So we could be looking at a replay, in a sense, of the GST.
Well, I think it's going to be bigger than a replay of the GST. The GST was, it was a big jump in thinking. Once you'd paid the GST once, it was over with. You got used to it very quickly, because just think how many times you actually open your wallet during a day. Signing a new employment contract, changing jobs, beginning a new job, that's not an everyday thing. The GST was an everyday thing.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the campaign, actually, more than
it's linked in. It's really the sort of psychological impact. This has a much more profound impact on people. It's a much deeper impact on people. It's something you really have to sit back and think about a lot more carefully than the GST. And it's why it's probably going to actually create much deeper problems than the actual implementation of the GST did. When you're going to have to put up a package that is going to be very complex if you are replacing the existing award structure and then put it through the Parliament, that might actually be the easy part. It's the consequences afterwards. I mean, one of the roles that the Australian Democrats used to play in the Senate was actually protecting the government from the unintended consequences of their own handiwork. You know, they'd put up,
That's a great definition of the Dems.
No, well, seriously, yes. They'd put up the positive amendments, and yes, the government would say, oh, yes, you know, we're consulting, we'll accept your amendments, even though, of course, they're covering up our own errors, and we'll happily brush them under the carpet and get the legislation through. Mm. This is an immensely complicated bit of legislation with immensely deep impacts for most Australians, and impacts that could take a long time for people to actually wake up and realise.
And there was a fairly quick reaction to the trade union television campaign that seemed to sort of get some traction, and they're back with their second go at it, aren't they?
They're keeping on going, and I think actually one thing that the government has actually forgotten is what the trade union movement does. They sort of tend to think the trade union movement is a conduit of funds to the ALP. Okay, that's something they do every now and then, but not necessarily all the time. What the trade union movement does do is campaign, and it campaigns for essentially individual workplaces, sometimes across industries. But of course, when you're running a small campaign, it's very easy to scale it up and apply what you learn to a whole national campaign. And I literally think that the government, to a certain degree, had actually forgotten that trade unions exist to campaign and has been caught out by the strength of the campaign they can run.
As you know, we at Radio National are covered by the Morticians Union. What branch of the trade union movement looks after your interest, Christian, when you're negotiating with Crikey?
Oh, look, I think it's time to pinch the Cheryl Curnow line and say miscellaneous workers. Emphasis on miscellaneous.
OK. Well, Christian, thank you for that. That was a spirited report on IR. And while we'll stick with initials, this is LNL on the ABC. That's ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and, of course, the pod. Coming up, Wormwood Forest, a natural history of Chernobyl. As I was reminding you, dear listener, it's just on 20 years since reactor number 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant exploded. Now, the force of the explosion was not, in nuclear terms, enormous, but it released as much as 400 times the amount of radiation as the Hiroshima bomb, and it caused radioactive fallout all across Europe, from Scandinavia to Scotland. Now, when the core of the reactor went into meltdown a week later, even more radiation was released, and about 75% of it settled in the European part of the Soviet Union, mainly in Belarus, which shares its border with Russia and the Ukraine. Now, about 135,000 people were excavated from the area, and the Soviet authorities created a zone of exclusion or a zone of alienation around it. Now, today, that zone is, yes, a mixture of ghost towns, but as I said earlier, there's a surprising abundance of flora and fauna. And within that abundance, some fascinating facts are emerging. Mary Mysio is an ethnic Ukrainian who was working as a lawyer in Los Angeles when the disaster occurred. She decided to quit the law and began researching and writing about Chernobyl full-time. She was the Kyiv correspondent for the LA Times and now lives in Kyiv permanently. And Mary recently ventured into that zone of alienation. Isn't that an extraordinary term? And has just written a book about it with the fascinating title, Wormwood Forest, A Natural History of Chernobyl. Let's start with the title, Mary, because, of course, I recognise that it derives from the Bible, but you found some very strange connections between Chernobyl and Wormwood.
Well, I'm not the one who found the connections. Other people found them, but I certainly heard about them. Wormwood is one of the botanical cousins of a plant called Chernobyl in Ukrainian. And when the reactor exploded, a lot of people traced this sort of botanical synonyms to the Book of Revelations, where the falling of a star called Wormwood is one of the signs of the apocalypse. And because of that apocalyptic connection and nuclear war and radiation, it was a very apt sort of metaphor that kind of really went through the Soviet rumor mill like wildfire. And they even had to bring out priests of the Russian Orthodox Church to say that no man can know when the end is near, and so don't worry about Chernobyl.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, in Christian legend, Wormwood sprang from the tail of the biblical serpent, did it not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Wormwood in the Bible is a symbol of calamity and sorrow and, in general, bad things. Though purists would argue that the biblical wormwood is not the kind of wormwood that was found in Ukraine. It would be Artemisia Judaica. But, sorry?
No, I'm just delighted by your attention to botanic detail here.
Well, once you start making claims about biblical revelations, I think you have to be very careful.
Well, you make a rather charming point yourself. You say, far be it from me to dismiss biblical prophecy, but it seems like the only end Chernobyl heralded for certain was that of the Soviet Union, because we tend to forget that 86 was the start of the Glasnost period. And here's Gorbachev. He's only been president for a year. The Soviets still pretty much closed off. The Soviet authorities are still in the habitually controlling the release of information. But here was a secret that could not be kept.
Mm-hmm. No, it couldn't be kept. In fact, had it been possible to keep the secret, we might not know about it to this day. The Soviet Union certainly kept a lot of its previous nuclear accidents secret. But what happened was the cloud went far beyond the borders of the Soviet Union, and it was very easy for scientists to pretty much do these kind of nuclear forensics to figure out what had happened and when. And once they were saying what had happened and when, that put the Soviet Union on the spot to sort of admit what was going on. But keep in mind that they were admitting to the West not much of that information. They were not admitting all that much information to their own people.
Tell us about the evacuation. I understand that on the Sunday afternoon after the explosion, in the early hours of the Saturday morning, over 1,000 buses drove into town and evacuated the entire population.
Well, this is the town of Pripyat, which was the workers' town for the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. There were 47,000 residents at the time, and they were evacuated in the course of several hours by these 1,000 buses that you talked about. But because of a certain amount of chaos that I think is not the fault of the Soviet Union, I think it would be impossible to evacuate any comparable town in the West without also a certain amount of chaos and uncertainty.
Hmm.
A lot of these bus drivers spent the night in Pripyat outside while the plant was burning. So a lot of the bus drivers got undue radiation exposure that could have been avoided. But that's only the residents of Pripyat were evacuated during the weekend while the disaster was still happening, because the disaster took 10 days for the fire to burn.
Yes, the way it unfolded. But the rural areas in a 30-kilometer zone around the reactor were evacuated 1 week after the explosion because the core was heating up again.
Well, actually, they weren't they weren't evacuated a week out. They were evacuated kind of piecemeal over many weeks. The evacuation of the rural areas took much longer than the evacuation of Pripyat. And to this day, I haven't really been able to, even though I've been researching this for ages, have not been able to really get clear facts about when that evacuation was completed. But in the end, you had this about 135,000. Those numbers differ as well, depending on the source. But keep in mind that throughout the course of the 90s, because there were people living on very highly radioactive territories, they weren't evacuations at that point. You might call them resettlements. They continued. So in the end, if you look at Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia, 350,000 people were resettled because
of
that.
Wow, yeah. And, of course, there's a 100-mile perimeter of barbed wire erected around that 30-kilometer zone with guards and watchtowers. Now, the nuclear plant was cleaned up, or that partly because Moscow wanted to keep it running. I remember at the time finding this mind-boggling. There were four reactors and three were kept in operation. Are any of them still running?
No, the last reactor was shut down in December 2000.
Was that at G7's behest, or did Moscow make... I'm sorry, was that decision made autonomously, independently?
Oh, no. This was under heavy pressure from the West.
Hmm. What do we know about the levels of radiation that were released from Chernobyl?
The estimates really vary. One reason why it's not completely known is because nobody's really sure how much of the fuel and fission materials are left inside the reactor. Simply because it's too radioactive, if you look at the models of what the reactor, what's inside underneath the sarcophagus covering, it's just a mess. And there are some areas that are totally inaccessible to people, and even robots have a hard time.
Mm.
So they've only accounted for about, I don't want to be too definite about the numbers, but they've only accounted for less than 90% of the fuel. But that could be because the fuel is under other debris, and they just haven't found it yet.
And Mary, the only radiation meter available at the time maxed out.
Yes, it did. It maxed out. The number I heard was 200 rem, which is in most cases, that kind of dose will give you radiation illness. But the estimated doses at the time of the accident were in the thousands of rem. And these will kill you in seconds. I mean, you can't survive that.
Well, some 600 emergency workers are sent in, according to your account, 500 hospitalized, 237 with suspected acute radiation syndrome, and 31 deaths. But that was pretty much in the short term. What happened with the hundreds of thousands who participated in the cleanup up to 2 years later?
Well, that's up to about 900,000 people took part in the cleanup. Their health...
Sorry, what was that figure?
900,000.
How extraordinary.
Yeah, because you have to keep in mind that these people are working very, very short tours of duty. So theoretically, as soon as their annual radiation exposure was achieved, they were shipped out and fresh people, quote-unquote, were sent in. So, yes, it was a lot of people went through that, through the Chernobyl hell. But their health is monitored constantly. They're definitely they're given probably better medical care than people who did not go through the disaster. But the medical effects of Chernobyl are very, very controversial. And I would say that nobody trusts anybody on the medical effects.
Mary, I can remember watching some of the film of people behaving with great heroism, I thought, going in, doing their best to sort of fix things. I assume they knew the risks they were taking and they were being hero workers of the Soviet Union. Your book says that most people didn't know about the radiation risks.
Well, certainly in the first night they didn't know about it. The first night they didn't even know that the reactor had exploded. They thought that there was a fire on the roof of the reactor building. So the first night they didn't know. It's very possible they didn't know in the days following. I talked to people who were brought in the days, well, I wouldn't say the days after the disaster, in the weeks after. Most of them were nuclear workers, But they were brought in. They were, again, fresh people, because the people who had been working at the plant at the time of the disaster had already exceeded their allowable radiation dose. So new people were brought in to run the reactors. But in terms of the people who were on the cleanup, a lot of these were draftees.
Mm.
They were conscripts. What did they know? What didn't they know? I don't think they knew very much. They knew there was radiation, but they might not have really appreciated what they were getting into.
This is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and podcast. And my guest is author Mary Marcio, who spent years writing about the after effects of Chernobyl's nuclear disaster. Let's get on to the environmental fallout. How big is the contaminated area, Mary?
The contaminated area is very big. I mean, it's millions and millions of acres. But in terms of the most highly contaminated area that's been evacuated, it is about 1,800 square miles.
Wow.
Which is the size, in American terms, I'm not sure what to compare it to in Australia. In American terms, it's the equivalent of about two Rhode Islands or about half of a Yellowstone National Park. It's a very, very large area.
Mary, tell us about your trip inside the zone of alienation, or the zone of exclusion, as some people call it. Why did you go?
Why did I go? The first time I went to do a newspaper story about the 10th anniversary of the disaster. I've been to Chernobyl approaching 20 times now. In fact, last Thursday I escorted a friend up there. That was my 18th trip.
Mm.
It's a fascinating place to visit.
Well, as your book dramatically demonstrates, clearly it's not that hard to get in. You can get permission.
Sure, you can get permission. The main problem is that they're understaffed up there, so they can't accommodate many kind of visiting groups. So you have to book in advance.
Okay, let's now go through some of the aftermath. Tell the listener about the Red Forest.
The Red Forest is a stand of pine trees that was very close to the reactor when it exploded. Because there are two aspects of the Chernobyl disaster. One is the explosion, which kind of expelled all this radioactive debris and rubble and pieces of the core. And then there was the burning of the graphite fire. That went on for 10 days. And that was more, without getting into this too much science, that was more like radioactive smoke as opposed to radioactive debris. The Red Forest was right in the line of the radioactive debris from the explosion. And because pine trees are very, very sensitive to radiation compared to other plants and other trees, the radiation killed their chlorophyll. And when the chlorophyll was killed, the trees turned red because they were no longer green, because chlorophyll is what gives them their green color.
What an unfortunate symbol, given the long history of red in Soviet culture.
This is true. So anyway, the trees died, and they were bulldozed on the spot. And new trees were planted to replace them. But the new trees are growing in a very stunted way, because it's a very, very, it's probably the most radioactive place on the planet outside of a nuclear power plant or something.
Now, the post-nuclear vision of the world is a barren wasteland where cockroaches proliferate. Not much lives except for grotesquely mutated creatures, but you found some extraordinary wildlife there, including some quite rare bird species. Tell your Australian listeners about that.
Well, there are about 250 bird species that have been counted in the zone, including species that were never found there before the accident, and endangered and rare species as well. I'll give an example. Every European bird guide will tell you there are no great white egrets in the area around Chernobyl. And when I was there on Thursday, I saw about 20 of them. Within 5 minutes, I saw about 20 great white egrets. So the thing is that because of the absence of people, the zone has become a very attractive place for wildlife.
Including the aquatic warbler, which is one of the rarest birds in the world.
Yes, including the aquatic warbler and black storks. Like I said, there's 250 different bird species there.
But do they have two heads? Are we looking at...
No, they don't. No, they don't. They look perfectly normal. The thing about, and this is why everybody asks why there are no mutants. There might indeed be mutants, but in the wild, the mutants don't survive.
That's right. Well, one does remember that picture of the eight-legged colt, which was shown to Gorbachev to demonstrate how badly the disaster was affecting animals. But that was kept alive, wasn't it?
Well, that was born on a collective farm. And keep in mind, and it's a misfortunate fact, but that you will get these kind of deformities in any population. The issue is, do you have an increase in such deformities because of Chernobyl? And thus far, no such increases have been detected.
It's interesting that the only mutant birds that have been described are the barn swallows, some males becoming albino, but the females avoid breeding with them.
Yeah, well, that's another problem with mutants is that they find it hard to find girlfriends and boyfriends. the opposite sex doesn't find them attractive. Yeah, they don't want to mate with them. The same is true of stag beetles. There are these asymmetric stag beetles that also have a hard time.
There is nothing less attractive, than an asymmetric stag beetle. How did the frogs go? Because they're meant to be very sensitive to environmental change.
Well, the frogs are perfectly normal. You're more likely to find a deformed frog in the United States, where there's been this kind of very strange explosion of frog deformities, than in Chernobyl. In Chernobyl, the frogs are perfectly fine.
Mm.
This is the irony, the paradox of Chernobyl, is that all the wild animals are doing extraordinarily well.
There was a fascinating study in the aftermath of Mount Helen, where the environmentalists got it wrong. They thought it was going to take a huge amount of time before there'd be any nutriments that would support regrowth. But they came bouncing back because they hadn't factored in the death of insects. And millions of dead insects formed a sort of a loose topsoil that plants could grow in. But I understand that insects didn't do too well around Chernobyl.
Well, some insects didn't do too well, especially the insects that where the larvae are in the soil, where they have a long development period in the soil, because the soil is very radioactive. So, for example, in the zone, at least for a time, there were fewer May bugs than there were outside the zone, because May bugs spent several years as larvae in this radioactively laced soil.
Well, Mary, one of the final chapters in your book is called Homo Chernobylus. Tell us about the people. Have they started to move back inside the area?
People started, after the evacuation, some people came back to the zone the very next year, 1987. These people are called self-settlers, or squatters, you might call them, but they resent that because they consider that they are natives. They're returning to their homes. They're not squatters. But they are there kind of illegally, semi-legally. This is in the Ukrainian zone. Belarus does not allow any squatting whatsoever in its zone. And Ukraine and Belarus are a little different in how they handle matters. In Ukraine, there were a maximum of 1,200 people in 1987, but because these are overwhelmingly elderly people, and most of them are women, they have been, basically it's just natural attrition. They've been basically dying off over the years. So this year there are about 300 of them left.
The Ukrainian tabloids make sensational news out of unconfirmed reports about criminals using the zone for illegal trafficking, dumping bodies of murder victims, and fascinatingly, for growing radioactive marijuana and poppies, which would be lovely. It would glow in the dark, wouldn't it?
You could find it easily.
Yeah. But the thing that surprised me, Mary, is that you'd expect that farming and raising animals would be prohibited throughout the zone, but that is not what you found.
Well, no, because the people who live there, these so-called squatters, they do their own subsistence farming, and they have farm animals. But in general, but we're talking only about 300 people. This is not a large amount of cultivation or livestock breeding. In general, there is no cultivation in the zone, at least on an industrial level, except for maybe a little bit of gardening here and there.
What about the incident? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. What about the incidence of thyroid cancer? It was expected to be very high, particularly amongst kids.
Well, yes, it was expected to be high, but it was not expected to happen as soon as it did. Most scientists were expecting thyroid cancers to take off around 10 years after the accident, but the increase started 5 years afterwards. This is the only health effect of Chernobyl that is absolutely indisputed. Everybody agrees that these thyroid cancers were caused by Chernobyl. And this is from people who were children at the time of the accident consuming radioactive iodine, probably with milk. That absorbed in their thyroid gland.
Okay, what about birth problems? I guess fertility might be down across all species.
Well, it might be. It's very hard to say. For example, the moose, they're called moose in America and elk in Europe. They, in general, usually have two calves, but in Chernobyl, they're more often seen with one. That could be an example of decreased fertility. In mice, Chernobyl mice, their litters are smaller than in non-Chernobyl mice. But the thing is that even if their fertility is lower, the vast numbers of animals mean that their populations are healthy.
What about Homo Chernobylus? What about humans in the region?
Well, humans in the region, there are people who work there. Their health is monitored all the time as well. The people, the squatters, live there full-time. Keep in mind that you're not allowed to work in Chernobyl full-time. You can only work half the month, and there are different formulas for that. But the people who live there, they're old. It's very hard to tease out what the effects of Chernobyl might be from all of the other effects of just poor medical care in the former Soviet Union.
Mary, has covering the story over the years changed the way you feel about nuclear power, or were you skeptical going in?
I right after Chernobyl, well, I was sort of kind of viscerally anti-nuclear. And when I first started going to Chernobyl, I was also anti-nuclear. But it wasn't really, Chernobyl didn't change my mind about nuclear energy. It was the fact that all forms of energy have costs.
Mm.
You know, right now we have the Iraq war, which I'm sure is not being fought for democracy. It's being fought for very other reasons.
Oh, you naughty girl to say that. I'm deeply shocked.
And when you look at the price of that, I mean, the Iraq war has taken a much higher human toll than, let's say, Chernobyl has, if you're talking about human life.
Mary, on that inspirational note, we will take our leave of you. I agree with you. Good on you. Mary Mycea's book is called Wormwood Forest, A Natural History of Chernobyl, and it's due to be released in about 1 month from now. We've got the only copy. The only copy in the Antipodes, and it's a great read. Oh, it'll be published by Joseph Henry Press. And before we play The Sting and get on to the Jehovah's Witness story, I suddenly remember Carl Krzyżanicki telling me that there is a lot of radiation pumped out in the Hunter Valley, where I live, out of coal-fired power stations. He says they have more radiation than a well-run nuke. Late Night Live, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web and the Pod. I've got to declare an interest on this story about the Jehovah's Witnesses. I always had a certain amount of sympathy for them, as religious cults go, because of the way they seem to have been singled out by the Nazis and put on the hit list, along, as I said, with Jews and Gypsies. Their martyrdom in the death camps gave them a certain amount of nobility. I fell out of love with the Witnesses a bit when you were going door to door in Victoria claiming to have converted a member of my family. So I find the next story really fascinating because it tells another side of the relationship of the Witnesses to the Nazis. For over 60 years, the leadership of the Witnesses across the globe have argued that the Witnesses were united in their opposition to Nazism and did not collude with the Third Reich. And yes, many Witnesses were taken to the camps and persecuted. But James Penton, who's a Professor Emeritus in the Department of History at the University of Lethbridge and the author of Jehovah's Witnesses and the Third Reich, Sectarian Politics Under Persecution, has come up with some quite extraordinary findings. And James is speaking to us from his home in Mexico. Welcome to LNL, James. I want the listener to know something about you, because I understand you were raised a witness in Canada.
That's right. That's right, I was. My great-grandfather became associated with the Watchtower Society sometime around 1900, and then through his daughter-in-law, my grandmother, and my parents, I was raised in the movement and experienced a ban on Jehovah's Witnesses as a boy and experienced all of the trauma of going to school when the flag salute was an issue. So my background is as a Jehovah's Witness, although I haven't been associated with that community for well over 25 years.
I would have thought that would have made it more difficult for you to write the book.
Well, in a sense it did, because I have very mixed feelings about the community, and it's very difficult to deal with it objectively when you have that background. Yet you have the knowledge that an outsider would never have. And so what I have had to do over the years as a historian is attempt to be as objective as possible. And, of course, no historian is absolutely objective.
Well, I think you've made a bloody good go at being objective, and but I just wanted to put that on the table so the listener understands. Now, let's not go into the history of the Witnesses too much, because we've only got, you know, 15 or 16 minutes to tell an extraordinary story. But it is necessary, I think, to explain that the Witnesses derive from this millennial Dawnist movement.
Yes, that's right. Its roots are in 19th century American Adventism, and it was influenced by a group out of Britain that came into existence in the Anglican and Presbyterian churches in the 1820s and 1830s.
And there was a connection way back when with the Zionist movement, which has become significant in light of what we're going to be discussing tonight.
That's right. Bible students, the forefathers of Jehovah's Witnesses, believed very firmly that the Jews would be returned to Palestine and that they were part of God's overall plan of redemption. And, of course, this was common with many very fundamentalist and millenarian sects in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
Well, it remains common, doesn't it, to this day, with many of the fundamentalists who are supporting George Bush in the Middle East.
That's right. That's absolutely dead on, and that's one of the causes for what's going on in the Middle East today.
Charles T. Russell plays a major role. He had that connection with the Zionist movement, but after his death, the Witnesses changed their attitudes to the Jews. Tell us in brief about that.
Well, actually, Russell's successor, Joseph Rutherford, Judge Rutherford, continued to support Russell's ideas about the Jews and the restoration of the Jews to Palestine until 1932. And then as he became frightened of the Nazis coming to power, and also there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the United States and Canada, he suddenly, out of the blue, decided that the Jews didn't have any role in prophetic history as far as the modern world was concerned, and he manifested characteristics of real anti-Semitism. The man was a border state American cracker, as they call them in the United States, a redneck, and his language showed that very clearly, and he made some very definite very, very definite anti-Semitic statements.
Okay, what kind of community were the Witnesses in Germany, and did they echo or reflect that American attitude to the Jews?
Well, before Russell's change, or Rutherford's change, rather, they were fairly sympathetic to the Jews. Then, as soon as he made this change, many of them picked up the common attitudes that were present in German society and ran with them. They were never racists in the sense that much of German society was, but they picked up on religious anti-Semitism. And for many years, many of them said that the Jews deserved what they got because they had never repented for having their ancestors killed Christ.
This is the voice of James Penton. James is Professor Emeritus in the Department of History at the University of Lethbridge. We're discussing his book, Jehovah's Witnesses and the Third Reich. What was the attitude of the Nazis to the witnesses when they first rose to power?
The Nazis hated the witnesses. Hitler in particular hated the witnesses. He must have known a good deal about them because he showed real antipathy. And the primary thing was that the witnesses were opposed to militarism, and they were an international organization based in the United States. And as a consequence of this, Hitler hated them. And the interesting thing is that they, along with the communists, were the first persons in Germany to end up in the concentration camps.
And but before that happens, though, James, there's an interesting moment, isn't there, in April 33, when the authorities in Prussia move against the witnesses, they seize their branch office, they outlaw their religious activities, and it takes the intervention of the U.S. State Department to have their properties returned.
That's right, it does. And at that time, of course, the Germans had to pay attention to what the Americans were saying. And I think that this is one of the best examples of positive American diplomacy. And I think the American State Department did it because of principles which I wish the American government would demonstrate more of in our present day.
Well said, James Benton. Now, tell us about the Declaration of Facts, which the witnesses released at that Berlin Convention in June 1933. This I found absolutely astonishing. I had no idea that they'd gone as far as they did in this declaration.
Well, this is the amazing thing, and they've hidden this for years. Really, what they said in this was that they had nothing to do with the Jews. They condemned the Jews. They condemned Great Britain and the United States. They condemned the League of Nations. They condemned big business. And the declaration was really but nothing but an attempt to ingratiate themselves with the Nazis.
Let me read a little bit out of from that declaration. The Jews are referred to as the representatives of Satan, the devil. Well, you can't go much further than that, can you?
Not at all. Not at all.
Mm. But you argue this is sort of opportunism or maneuvering rather than a deeply held conviction.
That's right. It was playing religious politics.
Hmm. Didn't work.
Didn't work at all, because the Nazis wouldn't have them, because they had too long a tradition of having been pro-Jewish and anti-military. And, of course, the Catholic Church in Germany and the Protestants hated them.
Okay, that's what the witnesses were saying in Berlin in June 1933. What were the witnesses saying elsewhere at that time?
Virtually the same thing. And in North America, they were constantly getting in trouble because of their attacks on the churches, above all big business, and on the politicians. And it didn't matter what politicians. Rutherford brought a great deal of persecution on Jehovah's Witnesses very simply because of the caustic terminology that he used about almost everybody. And you can't go around insulting every religious, political, economic group in the world with the possibility of the labor unions and get away with it.
Yes, they were not exactly doing a Norman Vincent Peale, were they, in winning friends and influencing people. Now, at this point, I want to go back, before we go on, I want to go back to the fundamental beliefs. Tell us how, what was going on in the beginning with the witnesses. What is their theological position?
Well, it arises out of their last days beliefs. They were convinced that the world was going to end in no time and that the whole system was really of the devil. Now, Russell had believed this too, but Russell was a much more gentle, much more tactful person than Rutherford, and he got into trouble, and the movement got into trouble largely because of their opposition to World War I. but so did many other pacifists.
Okay, let's just dwell on World War One just for a minute. They refused to take part, I presume.
That's right. And
so was Bertrand Russell. He was refusing to take part too, so there was a bit of a consensus.
That's right. And the fundamentalist religions in the United States, the evangelist Billy Sunday, carried on a crusade against them, as did many of the preachers, who became very, very pro-war. And one has to say that there's a pattern here that goes on from World War One, at least, up to the present. Some of the U.S. Fundamentalist clergy are calling for the invasion of Venezuela this morning.
Is that right? Yeah. Did the witnesses put a day on for the apocalypse? Did they say it's going to happen on March the 3rd, 1923, and have to then renegotiate when that failed to happen?
That's right. First, the major date was 1914. When that failed, then there was 1918, 1920, and they made a big thing out of 1925. And Rutherford himself said...
I'm sorry to laugh, but they're going to get it right one day, aren't they, if they keep, keep updating the prediction.
Their batting average is zero.
What's been the latest prediction, James, just in case I need to start packing and heading for the hills?
Well, they really pointed to 1975 and then to...
well, that was the end of the world in Australia because the Labor government was thrown out of office and... it's never been the same since, really.
Ah, very good.
Okay, so this is their coming in point. They are millenarian. They really believe that the end of the world is nigh. But what made them... the thing I've never understood is why... is there not a belief, or was there not an original belief, that only a very few people would be chosen to endure, to survive, to live on?
Well, that's a common belief. It isn't entirely true. What they believe is that only 144,000 persons ultimately go to heaven and reign as the church in heaven with Christ. But they believe that it's possible for millions to be saved to live here on earth eternally.
Oh, I see. And so there's an elite that goes to the upper house, as it were, but the rest of us can survive in the House of Representatives if we behave ourselves.
Exactly right. That's the situation. And only a minuscule number of persons today claim to be of that heavenly class. But they're the governing group within the community.
When you were a kid, did you have to go door to door seeking converts and selling literature?
Well, when I was a teenager, from 1940 to 1943, and really... on until after the war, there was a ban on Jehovah's Witnesses. And if you even had a copy of the King James Bible, it was printed by the Watchtower Society, you could be sent to prison.
But what the hell provoked that?
Well, quite frankly, it was the Catholic Church in Quebec that said to the Prime Minister and the Minister of Justice, ban these people, and they did. And... this has been one thing that has made me a thoroughgoing civil libertarian throughout my life, although I'm very critical of much of what Jehovah's Witnesses have done.
Yes, well, I'm with you. I defend to the death the rights of all sorts of people to say extremely silly things and to hold ludicrous beliefs. It comes with the territory in a pluralist society, doesn't it?
It does, very definitely. I think you and I are one-on-one on that.
How many witnesses lost their lives during the Nazi period? How many were rounded up and sent to the camps and died?
Well, the argument is that probably about 10,000 out of roughly 25,000, and of course many of them fell away by the wayside during the persecution, but 10,000 of them ended up in the concentration camps, probably about 1,300. Died for various reasons. The Nazis didn't want to kill them as they did the Jews. The Nazis wanted to force them to accept the Third Reich. And the ordinary people, you have to give them the highest marks going for bravery and decency in the camps. And there's tremendous witness to this effect. My criticism is not of the ordinary Jehovah's Witnesses in Germany, who were very brave, very decent people.
No, you're concerned with the hierarchy and its attempts, or their attempts, to negotiate with the Nazis.
Absolutely right. And to force the ordinary people in Germany into martyrdom when it very often wasn't necessary. You know, instead of keeping their heads down, Rutherford and the leadership in Switzerland called on them to go out and hand out leaflets throughout Germany under the Nazis. Well, you know, that's asking for martyrdom.
Mm.
It was crazy.
You make the point that, and I didn't realize this, I thought it was always a claim or a part of the Jehovah's Witness mission statement. You say it wasn't until the 60s and 70s that they started to claim their anti-Nazi credentials. Why was that? Why did they wait so long?
Well, for a variety of reasons. For one thing, they themselves weren't very interested in history. They wanted to push on. And the whole situation, the whole political situation in the Western world was such that the American government, the British government, and so forth didn't want to emphasize anti-Nazism because of the Cold War. They wanted to bring Germany on side. Even the Jewish community in the United States didn't focus on that until really much, much later. And the consequence was that there wasn't much currency in emphasizing the role of the Witnesses in Germany under the Nazis until the whole tradition of the Holocaust got going, which was really very much an aspect of Jewish policy, particularly in the United States. And then, as I say, the Witnesses jumped on the Holocaust bandwagon.
James, you won't be the most popular bloke in town with the Witnesses as a result of the book. What has been the hierarchy's reaction to it?
Do you know, I have... they won't comment officially on it. Any of us who have left the movement are regarded as apostates, and what they attempt to do is treat us as though we were non-persons and won't say anything.
I get quite a lot of emails from people in this position who are having a pretty rough time with being ex-witnesses, so you're one of them.
That's right, and yet individual witnesses have on talk shows and so forth have been pretty bitter and in some cases very nasty.
James, I'm not nasty. I think you've done a great job, but we've got to wind it. Thank you very much for your time. James's book is Jehovah's Witnesses and the Third Reich, Sectarian Politics Under Persecution, published by the University of Toronto Press. And, oh, I'm sorry, it's M. James Penton, who, as I said, is an emeritus professor. On our next, we're going to look at the legacy of corruption left to Palestine by Yasser Arafat. And we'll hear some amazing voice harmonics from Dean Frenkel. Now, stick around on ABC Radio National for the news. I want you to be a witness to the news on ABC Radio National. And look, with a bit of luck and some help from Jehovah, we'll see you later.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au. abc.org.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcasts.